Today's guest is Keith Clements, who is the current competition secretary, webmaster and former chairman of the Jarrett Car Club. Keith has owned his Jarrett Jupiter since 1969 and has competed in 27 countries with the vehicle over the years. Keith has also made major trips in Jarretts across the USA, Arctic Circle and the east and west coasts of Australia and Tasmania. In addition, he has toured the North and South Islands of New Zealand, again in a Jarrett. Keith also helps to organise the fleet of Jarretts that act as taxis for the Goodwood Revival. On the club side of things, Keith has been a major part of the team that has been a 3 times best stand winner at the Practical Classics Restoration Show. In 2012, Keith was voted Classics and Sport Car Club Personality of the Year. The club also won the title of Club of the Year in 2013. Keeping things in the family, Keith's daughter won the Classic Car of the Year in her own self-restored Jarrett Jupiter in 2010. Good afternoon, Keith, and thanks for your time.
Oh, hi, Kevin. Yes, it's good to spread the word on Jarretts.
I'd like to take you to your, if you like, your earliest memories of vehicles or your earliest automotive memory.
Yes, unlike a lot of people, my memories of childhood are very sparse. I'm not quite sure why. My parents didn't get a car till I was about 7 or so. And early journeys were with relations whose car struggled up some of the Devon Hills where I was brought up. My dad's first car was a massive Wolseley 680 and then progressed to a Riley 1.5, which is a little bit sporty, and I learned to drive on that, doing well over 1,000 miles before I passed my test 2 months after my 17th birthday. I can remember doing the tappets on my great uncle's Austin 7, I think, when I was about 15, but no other work on cars, although I probably helped my dad. So I'm not sure how I later acquired such a mechanical passion. My love of driving probably came through being in a pop group when I was 13 and driven around by the manager in a beaten-up A35, brushing both sides of the narrow Devon lanes when going to gigs and parties. Then I was off to Liverpool University to do the same course in mechanical engineering with a school friend with whom I travelled. His minivan took us on an ill-conceived journey to Vienna at Christmas, to visit my exchange friend. We were stuck at the bottom of the Arlberg Pass on the way back and slept in the van in minus 25 centigrade weather. We were woken up by the snowplow in the morning, which we followed over the pass on summer tyres. And this was my initiation for international motoring. Interestingly, I had a beard at the time and my beard was solid ice. And the whole of the car was coated in about a quarter of an inch of ice as we've been breathing out you over the night.
Lucky escape then.
So we didn't feel the cold in those days.
I think
we felt anything, actually.
This is true.
Now, the sort of same year, I went on summer vacation when I worked on a farm in Ontario, in Canada, where I found a VW Beetle languishing rusted solid in a barn. I unseized the valves and the brakes, insured it, and phoned a girl I'd met on the plane to see if she wanted to travel to the lakeside for the weekend. I was in search of some salmon. I love salmon, but I don't like fishing. But it was the wrong season, and we ended up doing 7,000 miles in search of it. The story is a long one, of course, with the car failing in some way almost every day. It took us overnight over the Rockies to the north of Jasper, where there was only a track with planks of wood as bridges. The Beetle's suspension broke in Oregon on a hairpin and the car rolled a few times. The car's wiring melted going across the Mojave Desert and the distributor gear stripped just outside Amarillo. After this, I had to drive 23 hours a day for 3 days to get back to Toronto to catch the plane. This had been my initiation into fixing cars. As I said, the rear suspension broke and I had to hitchhike into the nearest garage, which is about 65 miles away, to get one spanner and one new upper link arm for the suspension. And with that one spanner, which I've still got, a huge, huge thing, because I wasn't carrying any tools, of course.
No.
Fixed it and carried on driving. It gradually lost cylinders. In fact, when we got back to Canada, it was only on two cylinders. And going on the bridge across between the border, there's quite a sort of humpback bridge, a very big one, and the car wouldn't make it over. And the queue of traffic sort of piled up behind us, and some other people got out, pushed us over, and we rolled down the other side into the border post. Yeah, what's quite interesting is that over the last couple of years, as you mentioned, sort of in the intro, I've done a couple of long journeys, and one of these was travelling down the old Route 66 in a friend's javelin, when we did a 7,000-mile journey from California to Carolina and back. And of course, I remembered some parts of that journey as
I
we
bet.
travelled the whole Route 66, because in those days the interstates weren't built. Yeah, and well, last year now, as we're into the new year, it did another journey, which was from Los Angeles to the Arctic Circle and back. Once again, another 7,000 miles in the
Wow.
same car as we went from coast to coast. And, well, we made it even harder because we started off going up over through Death Valley
Yeah.
and Baker's and so on,
Right.
and the temperature was 108 Fahrenheit,
Ooh, wow.
which is quite a struggle at 7,000 feet for an old car. And amazingly, we actually suffered some punches because of this. Because and the other interesting thing was we stayed at a place called the Clown Motel. Brilliant place. When we came out in the morning, we found the weights had melted and come off the wheels. Incredible, it was that hot. Anyway,
Wow.
so
That is amazing.
we really, the only problems we had on that journey were tires. Obviously, the roads were hundreds of
Horrible.
miles of gravel and
Yeah.
this type of thing as we got up into British Columbia
It's
and
testament
the
to the
Yukon and so
engineering,
on.
though, isn't it?
Well, the Javelin's got some brilliant
Yeah.
brilliant suspension on it anyway.
Why a Jowett, I suppose, would be my next question.
Yeah, it's one of those moments, I guess. I was sitting either in the cafe or the bar, I can't quite remember, when I was a student at Liverpool University, thumbing through the Exchange and Mart, car classified ads. I suppose I was looking for a car, basically, and I saw an ad for a Jarrett Jupiter. I ain't got a clue what these were, but luckily a fellow student with a Riley Pathfinder enlightened me as to what it was, and we went off to see it. Of course, I bought it. On the way back, the main bearings failed, and luckily the seller agreed to pay the cost of the part, and I think I paid the princely sum in the end of about 40 quid for the car, so not bad, eh? And
No,
I ended up
indeed.
rebuilding the engine with a reconditioned crankshaft, but I only had I'd gone to the university library and managed to get an exploded view of the engine, which is all I had really to
Might
rebuild the
be
car.
a good point here for the listeners to explain the difference that you might have had with that engine compared to everything else around that time, and still to a degree the difference in that type of engine too.
Yes, I mean the Jowett is really very unusual because it's an aluminium split crankcase, horizontally opposed four-cylinder engine, it's held together basically by six bolts, which was one of the problems I had because I couldn't find the sixth bolt. It's actually hidden underneath what's called the balance pipe between the two halves of the engine. And I couldn't find that, and I was trying with chisels and everything trying to get the damn thing apart, and it wouldn't come. Eventually, I managed to get it apart. But yeah, those are the little things when you haven't got a workshop manual or anything.
Learning
And
experience.
yes, and of course, being aluminium and not particularly brilliant aluminium, it does it did over the years suffer from corrosion and this sort of thing. Because I guess this was before the days when people understood about antifreeze and inhibitors and all this type of
Yeah,
thing.
and you say you were doing that whilst the Apollo crew were landing on the moon, so that's going to be 68, 69, I guess.
69, yeah.
Yeah.
I was actually rebuilding the engine in my mate's front room, and when I was installing the engine, it was sort of outside the front room window, and I was watching the Apollo crew landing on the moon. I think it was at night. I can't exactly remember. I certainly remember working on the car quite late at night, trying to put it back together. So all these little problems started my sort of 40 years of frustration with Jowett, and it continued because I then had to go back to Devon before I started my job in Bedford. And along the way, I just have quite a few more issues, including one of which was the exhaust pipe falling off at the manifold. And of course, travelling late at night through some cities. It was very, very loud. Oops. And I had quite a headache by the time I got home. Yes, and, you know, problems did continue. A few months later, I'd started living in a bedsit in Bedford, and the gearbox had failed just spectacularly on the A6, blocking the road. And once again, I started to rebuild the box in the bedsit, didn't have a garage, and the landlady didn't take too kindly with that.
She nearly
threw me out, really threw me out of the bedsit. But lucky for me, there was a girl at work who offered her dad's garage to work on it.
Yeah,
and so I took it round there and managed to fix the gearbox. And yeah, this girl had obviously fallen in love with the car, and she eventually became my wife.
Sure, so she took a bit of a liking to you as well then.
Oh, I'm not too sure.
I was showing my wife some of the pictures and stuff, and I showed her a picture of a Jupiter yesterday when I was showing her the notes I had. She said, "What a beautiful car," and that's no word of a lie.
I was working shift work at the time, and I used to finish the shift and go to the nightclub 10 o'clock at night, and used to take the Jupiter there, and I can remember one occasion I had seven people giving them a ride home in it, which, if you imagine, it's really only a two, perhaps three seater. It was quite a challenge. Yeah, we had four people sort of sitting around the hoop of the anyway, so that's lots and lots of memories with the car. And to carry on really with my early years, in 1987, I started racing and competing in national and international rallies in my Jupiter. And although I spent about 10,000 hours preparing and then repairing the car after races and rallies, it's never been restored. And and after 65 years of this, the car's never been off the road. And it's been abused with sort of gravel on the Welsh forest stages. And remember coming back after one rally and the whole of the underside of the car was brilliant shiny metal, where the gravel had taken all the paint.
Blasted.
Yeah, and a kindly guy just outside Fez, a kid just outside Fez, put a huge rock, Fez in Morocco, that is, for our international work guys, put a huge rock in the middle of the road, and luckily I put a sump guard on, and we were flying through the air literally in the car. And came down right on top of this this rock, and that sort of dented the chassis.
Did you drive it out to Morocco, or did you ship it?
Yes. It was a rally it's a Pirelli marathon that started from Versailles Palace, in Paris, France, and we travelled all the way through the France. In fact, the suspension broke in the Dordogne on a very deep pothole, and on a special stage that was, and I had to drive to the end of the stage with one wheel sort of hanging off and very little brakes, and some of the competitors I overtook didn't quite realise I hadn't got any brakes. At the end of the stage, a farmer sort of helped a little bit, and we managed to wire the suspension back on, and then there was an end of leg section in a place called Carcassonne, which is a lovely city on the Spanish-French border. I was there busy trying to take this torsion bar out, and I'd seen this guy walking his dog about.
It's time for a break, and we'll be back with our guest, Keith Clements, shortly. Welcome back. We're with Keith Clements from the Jowett Car Club here in the UK.
I was working shift work at the time, and I used to finish the shift and go to the nightclub sort of at 10 o'clock at night, and I used to take the Jupiter there, and I can remember one occasion I had seven people giving them a ride home in it, which, if you imagine, it's really only a two, perhaps three seater. It was quite a challenge. Yeah, we had four people sort of sitting around the hoop of the
it's the fun, isn't it,
of the hood. Anyway, so that's lots and lots of memories with the car. And to carry on really with my early years, in 1987 I started racing and competing in national and international rallies in my Jupiter. And although I spent about 10,000 hours preparing and then repairing the car after races and rallies, it's never been restored. And and after 65 years of this, the car's never been off the road. And it's been abused with sort of gravel on the Welsh forest stages. And remember coming back after one rally, and the whole of the underside of the car was brilliant shiny metal, where the gravel had taken all the paint off.
Blasted.
Yeah, and a kindly guy just outside Fez, a kid just outside Fez, put a huge rock, Fez in Morocco, that is, for our international work guys, put a huge rock in the middle of the road, and luckily I put a sump guard on, and we were flying through the air literally in the car. And came down right on top of this this rock, and that sort of dented the chassis.
Did you drive it out to Morocco, or did you ship it?
Yes. It was a rally it's a Pirelli marathon that started from Versailles Palace in Paris, France, and we travelled all the way through the France. In fact, the suspension broke in the Dordogne on a very deep pothole, and. On a special stage that was, and I had to drive to the end of the stage with one wheel sort of hanging off and very little brakes, and some of the competitors I overtook didn't quite realise I hadn't got any brakes. At the end of the stage, a farmer sort of helped a little bit, and we managed to wire the suspension back on, and then there was a... an end of leg section in a place called Carcassonne, which is a lovely city on the Spanish-French border, and I was there busy trying to take this torsion bar out, and I'd seen this guy walking his dog, and about half an hour he came back. We were still struggling. I think we'd flattened various batteries out of the drills that we were using to try and drill out the stud that had broken. He came back past walking his dog, and he didn't speak any English, but luckily my daughter, as my navigator, spoke a bit of French, he took my daughter off with the part and came back about an hour later having made a new part for me, his lathe at home.
Excellent.
Now, this guy was an ex-Paris-Dakar mechanic, so he knew what he was doing.
Perfect. That's the ideal person to happen upon.
That was that Pirelli Marathon, we managed to get through a sandstorm in the Sahara Desert, and that's really frightening when you're driving an open-top car in a sandstorm, I tell you. Luckily, I prepared the car for it, but I hadn't prepared us. We hadn't taken dust masks.
The
car had got superb. I used vacuum cleaner bags over the air inlets and put those on.
Oh, okay.
And that worked anyway. And the poor old car's been through snow and ice in the Scottish Highlands and various other places. It's had various excursions off the track at Donington, hitting the Tyrwhitt and hitting the Armco at Prescott Hill Climb. Not major dents, but all little bits of patina that have. Been accumulated over the 40-odd years that I've used it, and I think the last journey, big journey that it made, was a 13-country tour around the Baltic, it took quite a hammering on the Latvian roads, various other places in Poland and Lithuania and so on, and. I'm actually decided last month to give my Jupiter a bit of serious attention. So today I've been down the garage. The body's off, the chassis there, all nicely painted, and yes, a complete
got her in dry dock then.
bare metal bolt restoration. So after I think it's 47 years of ownership, I've finally got round to it.
Wow, there you go. So I noticed you had some other cars around the few of the years as well.
Yes, I mean my Jupiter was my first car, but when the gearbox went, I went out and bought a very practical car, which was a 3/4 race cam MGA 1600, which was not very practical, but great fun once you sorted out when to change the gears. We also had somehow accumulated three half-working bubble cars that I used. I think my wife used them, and my brother-in-law used them as well. But
Isettas or Messerschmitts or?
There was a Heinkel, Messerschmitt and Trojan.
I interviewed the lady from the bubble car museum up near Boston.
Yes, they've become very popular. I mean, I've seen them sort of down at Goodwood and been to a few auctions recently, and they're actually getting very expensive. You know, they're getting 20 grand now, some of them. I mean, incredible prices for bubble cars and so on. But there
it
we
is.
Go.
No, it's amazing.
Yeah, so my workshop has got that bit of work going on, and also has is a javelin, which had been imported from New Zealand by a Swiss friend of mine. And I drove it, or helped drive it back from Switzerland to go to a rally in Wales. The guy decided he wanted to have it painted, but that's turned into a full restoration because the bangs that we were hearing were actually quite serious flaws in the in the rear suspension. So it's been a full body off restoration, like I guess all cars that have been used for so long, particularly in New Zealand where the roads are not particularly brilliant. The car had needed some attention, and that's what we're giving it anyway.
Yeah, I noticed that you've mentioned that it's there's a documented path of the restoration on the Jarrett talk under the topic early javelin restoration. If someone wants to look at that, that's interesting.
Yes, yeah, we got that, and back on the sort of other cars that I had. I mean, I nearly bought an E-Type Jaguar, from a fellow at Jarrett Honer, which he imported a couple from the USA. Sadly, I decided not to buy it because I didn't want two sets of spares. I thought they'd all get jumbled up. I'm not particularly organised, and you know, it's
that would have helped the retirement fund now, I thought.
Yes, I mean, I've always, I think I've been had a riding one in the 60s, and there are probably the most sexy car that's ever been made, I think. But there we go. It is a big regret, but
even stated by Enzo Ferrari that's the case as well. So
is it?
Yeah, he said that's the most beautiful car he'd ever seen, including his. The reason I say that, I'm reading a book about him at the minute, and that was just one of the things that just popped into my head when you mentioned the E-Type. So if he likes it, I guess it must be okay, or liked it.
Yeah. And the other car that acquired was, I thought I'd buy one for my daughter when she was 1 year old. And I bought a basket case of the rare Jarrett SC Jupiter. I think there are only 69 of these made, so it's fairly rare. I had the intention of restoring it for her 18th birthday. That didn't happen because I started racing. Club members had helped me restore it, and we got it. The chassis was done, but nothing else, and it was languishing in the garage for a while. And my daughter came round when she was 30, and offered to help finish restoring it, which she did. And 2 years later, with once again help from Jarrett friends, during some long evenings because we were all working at the time, and the car won Classic and Sports Car of the Year. Which you can also read about in the blog on the Jarrett Talk website forum.
Yeah, can't do much better than that, can you, to be honest?
No, I mean, it's impressive. It's an amazing story.
That is impressive. And you got there's another one that she inherited as well from your wife, then got some mileage on it.
I got a javelin. I've been another Jarrett owning friend lived reasonably close to me, and he was getting old, and I used to take him to all the club events in my car or his. When he died, he sort of offered me first refusal on his javelin, and bought it for my wife. And this car had done 500,000 miles. He was an outside broadcast cameraman and then the sort of chief accountant of the BBC, so he was quite a guy. He had owned it from you, done 500,000 miles on it, and we've acquired it and put probably quite a few tens of thousands of more miles on, going to places like Le Mans in it and Goodwood.
That's amazing.
For the last 15 years.
So, that is amazing. Have you ever had one that you've a car you've sold and you thought, the second it's driving off down the road, I really shouldn't have sold that?
No, not really. I've owned cars which, I mean, I had a lovely Subaru Legacy GTB, an amazing car, which I imported from direct Japan because you couldn't buy them over here. Mm. And that was an amazing car. I didn't really regret selling it. I think I'd had Subarus for about 15 years, Legacies, and loved every minute of them. But
I was wondering about that because obviously there's a bit of synergy, or what you'd like to call it, between the engine etc. with Subaru and Jarrett. So I wondered whether there would be some relationship that, that would draw you towards Subarus, really, because of the technology or the design, which is interesting.
Yeah, I guess so. I think at the time, Colin McRae was still whizzing around in the Subarus, which is one of the first buy I bought them there, and they were being voted sort of the best car by various magazines and so on. And yes, it is a flat four, horizontally opposed engine, and one or two people have actually fitted them into Jowett's.
I did wonder about that, because I've seen them in VW Bugs, so I wondered whether they would put them in a Jowett as well. So that is interesting.
Yeah, I don't think they've been particularly successful in doing that, but and somebody else, I think, has used a gearbox off a Subaru and this sort of thing, but it's a major modification to get it all to work. And there's also, I think, a little bit of a story that Subaru actually did buy a Jowett engine in the 50s. But I don't think they ever sort of copied it. I mean, there are quite a few other flat four engines around, and there was a lot of exchange of technology, I guess, in those years between manufacturing companies. Mm. I mean, Jowett engines were sent off to General Motors and all this type of
Yeah, I wondered because I'd read that in my research, and I thought I'd get you to either agree or debunk that one, and I kind of thought you would debunk it because, as you say, there's plenty of other flat fours around in it. So
yes, I mean I've read a very interesting document from Subaru on the development of their engine, and their mantra was balance, and they had balance of mechanical balance, of heat balance, of all sorts of balances, and I think, you know, it's quite a big volume. It's a book, in fact, on development of the Subaru engine. It's really where I guess Jowett might have gone.
It's time for a break, and we'll be back with our guest Keith Clements shortly. Welcome back. We're with Keith Clements from the Jowett Car Club here in the UK.
and then we were going through Lord March's estate and down through the golf course, and I sort of got the car up to about 70 mile an hour. I left the braking very late coming by the gatehouse. There was a little squeak from the back brake, and I put on the anchors. And he said, Sir Sterling said, "God, blimey, those brakes are good, aren't they?" I did tell you that this car had been modified quite a lot in period in the 50s by the previous owner, and he'd fitted servo brakes to it.
Oh, wow.
And sort of 1950s servo brakes, which were...
Very advanced.
and he'd put indicators on as well as trafficated with some very complex relay circuitry in it, and, electric fan and various other things that he'd put on, which... all sort of improved the car, and I guess showed the way as to where the car might have gone. If
they'd, absolutely, there's nothing really new. There's just different ways of doing things that someone hasn't already thought of, I think.
You were sort of talking about what else do I do? Well, you mentioned about the classic car show where we've been to that a few years, and support on the stand and the restoration show. A friend and I who really put it together. And we've won the best working stand there for 3 years running. And I think the organisers are getting quite fed up with us winning this prize every year. But we put on a fantastic show. You know, we've got a javelin on a rotisserie type thing. We've got somebody rebuilding an engine or a gearbox. We've got somebody else perhaps repairing, doing the leather work on a seat. And so on. So we always have something different every year, and we're obviously going for it again this year in a couple of months.
Was that a club stand at the NEC recently as well?
Yes, because I
had a wander around the stand then, which was quite a big crowd around.
Well,
it,
there were five cars on the stand.
Yeah, there was a huge crowd around one of them.
Javelin, a Jupiter,
I think
a
pre-war? It was a Javelin, I think.
A Javelin, the racing one. Yeah. Quite a nice car. He's done a lot of work to it. And the racing boy, I've stopped racing, but the racing boys have taken the car up to the next level. Mm. And the car is now doing 130 mile an hour down the Mulsan Straight. You know, it's amazing, which with a just a little bit of development work you can do. And Obviously, it's still not up to Subaru type
Dear.
power, but you're still using most of the original engineering. But yeah, it's brilliant, the time and the money to put into that sort of
Oh,
development.
absolutely. No, it's great. So
And
it's obviously the car's been a real entry drug into everything else then by the sound of it. So it's given you a whole sort of different life in terms of the social side of it and everything else.
yeah, it's not just a means of transport. I mean, it's been a social tool, as you've seen. It's managed to grab me a wife, but lots and lots of friends, and the rallies I've done. I've rushed and chatted up, chatted with many of my heroes, like Stirling Moss, Roger Clark, people like David Steele, even. All these people who are quite famous, but when you get them there, in that environment, they're just blokes. It's just brilliant
Well,
to.
I find cars are a great leveler, I think, as an interest. Some people I've run into that are quite well known at car shows and stuff like that. And as you say, they're just interested in the car. They're there to have a look round and, what's this do and all the rest of it. And no, I agree. It does give you a whole different. It's very relaxing too. You understand on the sort of computer type jobs can be quite stressful. And if you can go home and take something apart, or it gives you a whole different perspective, really, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, although I did mechanical engineering at university, I actually ended up doing nuclear engineering, which really got nothing to do with mechanical engineering. But and it's always been a hobby. I've never
Right.
worked in a garage or anything like that. So it's always been a hobby, and it's a way of going down my man cave and chilling out, really. Yeah,
No, absolutely.
and
Absolutely.
yeah.
Absolutely.
So and plus, the car's given me some incredible thrills. I mean, I've driven on roads that not even the locals know about. Their forest stages, their mountain passes. Which, if you were going on holiday, you would never find. And I've done that, through, let's say, 27 countries, basically. Huge, huge area, as well as basically just getting more out of a journey. You said you'd been up the coast road in the States, but doing it in a 1950s car is
Absolutely.
really totally different. You're not in an air-conditioned environment.
No.
We couldn't book hotels in advance because you never quite know if you're going to get there or not.
It does give the journey a whole different feeling. You see things that you don't normally see, and as you say, it takes you longer to get there. And a hill that was a hill that wasn't a hill in your other car is suddenly a big hill in your. It does
And
give
when
you a
you
whole
do
different
break
thing.
down, you meet people.
You do,
And this
yeah,
is a great thing,
absolutely, yeah,
and
absolutely,
you
yeah.
suddenly realize how really helpful people are,
Yeah, they are, and they want to look, don't they, as well? The ones. Can you give us a bit of a background to Jowett itself in terms of the company?
Sure, yeah. Around about well, in 1901, there are two brothers, William and Benjamin Jowett, and with their sister Ruth, they started the Jowett Motor Manufacturing Company. They had a capital of about 90 quid at the time, £90 that is, and they produced replacement engines for other cars, things like the Dion and so on. They eventually designed their own engine, a two-cylinder horizontally opposed engine, that they first produced in 1905, and they put that in a tiller-steered car in 1906. They started building cars, complete cars, then in 1910, and the first one they ever built was exported to South Africa, to a guy who wanted to climb Table Mountain in it. It was on a sailor return, but it never came back. And
No
so,
pressure then.
incredible, yes. And of course, that was the First World War then started, and when that finished, they formed Jowett Cars Limited, found a plot of land, and built a factory in Idle, which is just outside Bradford in England. And that factory continued. Basically, until they closed. Now, that engine that they designed, which is a 977cc engine, was used for all their cars, virtually, until 1954. There were some other engines which we'll talk about. During the pre-war days, the way that they rated or taxed cars was via a horsepower rating. But although that changed, this actual engine was both a 6 horsepower, an 8 horsepower, and then a 7 horsepower engine. Now, these were quite remarkable cars. They were designed to go up the hills in Yorkshire, which are quite steep, and they're quite a small engine, and quite easy to work on. and the British motor car manufacturing companies were challenged to do a cross Africa journey. So Jarrett's put two 1926 Jarrett's into this challenge, and they crossed the 3,800 miles between Lagos to the Red Sea in 60 days. There weren't very many roads then, but they still averaged 30 miles per gallon, and they did about 77 miles a day. And it's an amazing story. I mean, it's actually very well documented. The club has got the snapshots that were taken, the original snapshots
taken. As you say, you'd probably struggle to do that these days, to be honest.
Yeah, you'd probably need an arm guard, a tank. And this was all done without any support. These were two cars without any support.
Amazing.
You know, no other Europeans or anything were there at all.
Can-do attitude, that's the thing.
Yes, yes. I think some of it's rubbed off on me, actually.
Yeah, it sounds like it, actually. I was just going to say there's a fairly similar pattern to the journey there.
Well, the Australians have done a similar thing. They drove a couple of Bradfords around Australia. A couple of years ago. That's quite an interesting story as well. The two cars were called Wait and See. So on one of them they painted Wait and another they painted See. But I guess one of my ambitions would be to recreate that journey at some stage.
Yeah,
so carrying on with the story of Jarrett's, that's sort of the sort of pre-war stuff. I mean, various bodies and chassis were built around these two-cylinder engines. They did also produce a four-cylinder option around 1935. And this gave a bit more luxury and obviously a lot more power. I had a lovely drive in one of those in New Zealand, through the hills in New Zealand a couple of years ago, and it's a lovely car. Then, during the war, Jarrett's were thinking, oh, what are we going to do after the war? So they hired a guy called Gerald Palmer. He joined the company in 42, and he started designing this brilliant Javelin, which has got a luxurious and spacious interior. It's got wonderful suspension. Gerald was brought up in Rhodesia, and so he knew how to design a car for rough roads. The car's got a low centre of gravity. It's actually below the centre of the wheels. It's got a curved windscreen, one of the first cars in Britain anyway that had a curved windscreen. And it's got a very low coefficient of drag. In fact, the coefficient of drag wasn't bettered by a production car in the UK until the late 60s. So really quite an amazing car. And that came into production in 1948. So designed in 42, actually started production in 48. The war actually lasted a bit longer than they thought it would, I think. Now, they also created the Bradford van after the war using the same two-cylinder 1906 engine design. And the Bradford was a very popular car, a very profitable car, and it just keeps on going. It's been in pickup form and she's been used in lots of different vans. Now, I think Jarrett's also realised they needed to get a little bit of motorsport. The Javelin was doing reasonably well, but they started to talk to ERA, who, based in Luton, they sort of designed racing cars, and there's a guy there, Von Eberhorst, who also designed the Auto Union, who designed the chassis of the Jupiter, which is either a space frame or ladder frame tubular chassis made out of molychrome steel. Really quite paper-thin tubes. Quite a nice designer chassis. And they stuck the Javelin suspension on that, the Javelin engine in it, slightly uprated, and the gearbox. And that was exhibited at Earl's Court in 1949.
So that's quite a very advanced for its time, because that sounds a bit like the birdcage type cars that
yes.
came later on.
Yeah, well, I mean, the auto unions sort of were doing very well in Grand Prix racing just before the war. So Eberhorst knew what he was doing, and the Jarrett's actually offered the Jupiter. You can actually drive the car without any body on it. And Jarrett's offered that car to all the body designers, makers, and the coachcraft type people. And it went to, I think, about 30 or 40 different coach builders. in Switzerland and all around the UK. And there's a sort of book about all these cars. Yeah, I say there's quite interesting to realise that was a period when British coachcraft guys had, you know, they had something to work with and made some quite pretty cars. And subsequent to that, you know, people have got Jupiter chassis, and they've put modern fiberglass type bodies on them, some of those are quite nice as well. But
it's time for a break, and we'll be back with our guest Keith Clements shortly. Welcome back. We're with Keith Clements from the Jowett Car Club here in the UK.
So you can even, if you haven't got a body, put a sort of modern body on if you wanted to.
Well, it just shows you how good the foundation was, though. I think that's the key to it, isn't it?
Yes, and the thing about the Jupiter is that I think, as I said, Jowett's realised that they wanted to get into motorsport, and the third Jupiter they produce went out and it won its class at Le Mans in 1950. They entered it the next year, and it won again, and the next year, and not the same car, but a slightly different car. And so Jowett's won the Le Mans 1500cc class 3 years running, which is quite outstanding until the sort of Porsches came along. And now to celebrate that, my Jupiter was exhibited in the showroom at Le Mans in 2000 as a sort of celebration at the in the Club de l'Ouest clubhouse. Basically, it took a little bit of pressure. That's another time that I actually did a better preparation for it, just to make it look pretty. But it was still driven there. You've got to realise it was still driven there.
No,
it wasn't stuck
no,
in
that's
a
the, that's the
you
thing,
know,
isn't it?
Yes, so that was it. They also had success in motorsport with a javelin in Spa racing and in various rallies. And one of these, the Tulip Rally, or Tulpen Rally, as it is in Dutch, was won outright by Hugo van Zylen, van Nijveld. Now, he was a sort of Dutch aristocrat, and he won it outright in 1953, not a class win. And amazingly, he was invited to rerun it 50 years later in 2003. And I helped prepare a car for him, a javelin, and I navigated for him on this journey. And it's quite an amazing journey, because when he saw the car, he'd not driven a Jowett or really anything competitively since. He got in the car and his huge beaming smile as he sort of started to remember about this car.
I bet.
To see him overtaking much more powerful cars, and this was in July, there was still snow on the road and there were wet leaves on the road, and he was sliding it around the corners. It was quite incredible, you know, to navigate for a guy like that.
Yeah, what, anyway. What a thing would have been brilliant.
And of course, you know, that's 50 years since he won it. So, you know, he was quite old. Yeah, so Jowett were doing quite well in motorsport. And however, the Korean War was still going on, and EN36 gear steel was just unavailable. And Jowett boxes started giving problems. They also were building these boxes on old tools that were worn out through war production. And I learnt this because the company that eventually bought the plant, International Harvesters, had the same problems with the gearboxes using the same equipment. So, it's quite incredible when you think how underfunded things were in those days. Mm. Also, the bodies for the javelin were made by Briggs, who eventually became part of the Ford Motor Company.
Yes, yeah.
Because of the poor sales, sort of negotiations with Briggs sort of stalled. I mean, I think what happened to Jowett's wanted to stop production for a while, and Briggs didn't like that, and so on anyway.
Yeah.
Although they had designed quite a radical new idea, they actually built a whole range of cars based on the same engine, same chassis, and they were, it was called the CD range, and this was to be commercial vehicles, pickups and so on, saloons, and also sports cars, all on the same common design. A few prototypes were made, about four or five of them, but it never went into production. And the company was sold, it was still in profit, but the factory actually closed in 1954. Now, interestingly, every year the club hosts a reunion for the ex-employees of Jowett's. Now, there still are some, even after this time, and we've been holding this for quite a few years. And it's amazing to see all these people reminiscing about their times working in Jowett.
Is that near or at the factory site? Or?
It's in Bradford. Yes, we hold it in the centre of Bradford. The factory is now a Morrison's supermarket, which and if you go there, you'll find there is a sort of a montage or a wall dedicated to Jowett's there. So there is a little bit of a bit of memorabilia there, but yes, and the Jowett reunion is quite something. So if you, I think it's in August, but have a look at the website; it'll be posted there.
Okay,
you'll see quite a few.
Getting quite near the end now. I'll just give a quick whip through and just let us know what you have in the way of publications, etc. Do you have like a regular magazine or anything like that? Or
yeah, we have a great magazine that comes out every month. It's about 30 or 40 pages, that's we've got about 600 members, I guess, and so it's not a large club, we also have the club's organised into. There are a number of clubs around the world. There's one in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and the Americas. Now, all those clubs do have sort of some international members. The one in the UK is probably the largest. Well, it is the largest. And it's organised into regional sections. And there are about nine of those around the country. And each section organises its own local events. But we also have a national event once every year, held usually or always over May Bank Holiday, the end of May or the beginning of June, and that goes around the country. So each section sort of organises an event, which means we get to see different parts of the country. We've got a voluntary. We've got a spare service manned by voluntary officers that can supply parts for all the models. As you can imagine, this is quite an unusual club in the sense that it's got models from 1906 to 1954. So quite a range of cars. It's not a one model car. It's
no, absolutely. I mean, I was trying to think of a company that I could think from the American market that was similar and had a similar longevity, and the only one I could think of really was Studebaker.
Yeah,
because they went a similar time span and had the same sort of loyalty as well. So it was that was the company I was comparing it with the most.
Yeah, if you look at the designs of the Studebaker, they're very similar to the Javelin. Actually.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That was the two I could compare it with. That was the one that popped into my head. So no, that was really interesting. What are the future plans with the club? Do you have anything new coming up or?
We've got our 100th anniversary coming up in a few years' time, so we're actually planning some quite impressive things for that. I mean, we did quite a few good things in the 90th year. We sort of won Club of the Year then. So, there are things we're thinking about. Well, okay, what would have a Jowett looked like sort of 50 years on from when it closed? So, yeah, we could look at that. We'll probably be holding celebrations for around the country every month, so there'll be something going on that will excite the press, I guess.
That's great.
During that time, I think the main drive at the moment is to try and get younger members. I think the problem with all classic car clubs is that they tend to be people in their 60 and over. Although we've got a few members that are younger than that, we really would like more. And what's even more important is to get them involved in the committees, in the running of the club. I mean, you know, most of the people on the committee at the moment, they were on the committee before they were 30. And like myself, I was sort of 30 when I joined the committee, and why, you know, why can't we get, you know, that age group of people involved in
I agree. And one of the sort of hobby horses of the guys that I do the show with is the greying of the hobby. And one of their things is really to try and promote, you know, take a grandkid to a car show, etc., just to try and get, you know, some young sort of blood back into the hobby, really, or into the hobby. So I think there is signs of it. I must admit, I think there was a bit of a time where there wasn't too many youngsters looking at it, but I see more people with kids at car shows these over the last few years than I have done for quite a while. So hopefully that interest will continue.
I think there's certainly interest in older things. I mean, we see this at Goodwood. People love the fashion of the cars.
Absolutely.
They love the look of the cars and that sort of thing. And I think there will always be that in the classic car movement.
Yeah.
But you still need, you know, people to keep the cars going.
You do.
And the mechanics and the restorers around there. And I certainly think that industry has certainly been brilliant in the last few years. It's actually, you can get almost anything done these days.
Yeah, I mean, like things like, I interviewed a gentleman who runs Bicester Heritage a while back. And that's a real blueprint, I think. If they can get more campuses like that, where you've got like a one-stop shop for all the restoration things that you might need, where they can make you upholstery or, you know, make a part on a lathe or something like that. And I think the more places there are like that, people are more willing to go there. And because there's a bit of a one-stop shop mentality these days, isn't there? And I think that if you can get it all in one place, then that would help.
Yeah, I mean, I try to help. I have, in my workshop, I invite members to come along and we all share our ideas and that sort of thing. I'd like to take it a little bit further in some ways. I've got friends in Denmark. They've sort of got a hangar on an airfield. All the classic car enthusiasts have a little bit of space in this big hangar.
Mm.
Not all the same maker car, but that they all share their skills. And that's brilliant. I've seen a similar thing in Western Australia, where the stores are managed by four lots of different makes of cars. I'm feeling that might start happening.
You're right. I think that's a definite direction for it to go, because I mean, they do it in the States now. I think we've kind of got to the end now, actually, so it's been great
Kevin.
I hope the
listeners will go out and look at the website Jarrett.net.
Yep.
And get interested in Jarrett's. And if you've got any questions, just go via the contact page on Jarrett.net and I'll answer them.
I'd like to say thanks very much to Keith Clements from the Jarrett Car Club here in the UK. Come back and listen to us soon. Goodbye. Mm-hmm.